This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Joe Hill's new book, Strange Weather, is a collection of four short novels. In one, the sky rains nails that rip to pieces anyone unlucky enough to be outside. In another, a skydiver gets stuck on a cloud. And in a story without any supernatural elements, people with easy access to guns use them to devastating effect. Joe Hill is the author of many works, including the novels Horns, Nosferatu, and The Fireman. Joe Hill's here in the studio with me now to talk about his new book. Welcome to the program.
Peter, thanks for having me here.
Happy to have you here, too. I wanted to start by talking about the story called Loaded. In this story, there's a domestic violence incident that takes place in a mall, and it starts a chain reaction of shootings that just leads all the way up to the horrific ending, which I'm not going to spoil for people. But I did want to ask you to talk about what inspired that story, Loaded.
I mean, the short answer on that is Newtown, Connecticut. You know, the slightly more expanded answer is, I've thought about guns a lot. I've thought a lot about what's happening to this nation as a result of millions of guns floating around and the easy access to them. And there's a lot of argument about what to do and if anything should be done or could be done. And you see these arguments being played out across social media and traditional media. And everything that I could personally say about guns has been said and said and said, and it, you know, people have their positions fixed. They have their heels dug in. You know, they've settled on their position, and it's very hard to move them. And, you know, and I've done some arguing about guns online, but I reached a point where I thought, this is silly. You know, I never signed on to lecture anyone. Arguing with people on the internet isn't what I do. What I can do is I can write a story, and I can examine the facets of guns in America and the American fixation on guns and the problem of mass shootings. I can examine those facets in a work of fiction and give people a different way of looking at it and thinking about the problem. And if I did my job well, you get a story that's exciting, where it's fun to turn the pages and you feel suspense and you're excited to find out what happens next. And hopefully it sort of erases political barriers that, you know, you come to it as a reader. You're not there to argue. You're there to be entertained. And so your mind is open in a different way. And yeah.
Do you own a gun?
I don't own a gun. I used to shoot when I was a kid. Me and my buddy Chris Rulin used to shoot every Sunday afternoon on the NRA range in Bangor, Maine, or outside of Bangor, Maine. I do think as far as gun ownership goes in this country, again, there's been a lot of argument about it, but it seems to me that there's one thing that you should be able to agree on, whether you're vociferously against gun ownership or you're the most radical NRA member in the country. It seems to me one thing we should all be able to agree on is this, that presenting guns and gun ownership as a right is probably the wrong way to think about it, and that we should think about gun ownership as a responsibility. And I feel like that's something everyone can agree on, that owning a gun is a big responsibility. You now hold a death machine. You own a death machine and that you keep it in your house. And so then the question is, if we agree that it's not a right so much as a responsibility, the question is, where do you go from there?
With respect to the story Loaded, the thing that struck me about it, of course, as we mentioned, that there's no supernatural element here. It's
right.
Just guns plus human nature, and boy, it's scary.
Yeah.
It's really scary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's where we are, you know, and I've been asked a couple times if it's a political story. I don't really feel like it's a political story. I feel like it's a story of observation, you know, that this is, you look at Las Vegas, you look at Aurora, you look at Orlando, you look at Newtown, and this is the America we live in now. And the most amazing thing is that we've decided we're all right with that. We've decided to accept that entirely. And it's worth taking a close look at what we've all signed up for.
Assuming this is not supposed to be a political story, will you allow for the possibility that, you know, there's that old argument, right, where, you know, the thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with a gun.
Right.
And in this story, the alleged good guy with the gun gets into that situation, which is really confusing and makes it even worse.
Yeah, so there are problems with the good guy with a gun theory. You've got the, you know, the good guy with the gun in Las Vegas. The good guys with a gun did stop the bad guy with a gun. They stopped them after 60 people died. The bad guy with the gun is always going to be able to do plenty of damage if they're so inclined before the good guy with the gun ever gets to them. And, you know, the good guy with a gun argument has always been the formulation of the gun industry. And they love it. I mean, they love where America is. They think, you know, the people who sell guns, they've got the perfect formula. They sell the disease and they supposedly sell the cure. You know, they sell the weapons that perpetrate mass shootings and homicides and robberies and domestic abuse. And then they can also say, but if you have a gun, everything will be great. You'll be able to protect yourself. It's a crazy formula. And I would add, you know, anyone who can do math can see that the gun industry's formulation, their equation doesn't add up. If you have 100,000 people, and between those 100,000 people, you only have one gun, you're going to have inevitably a lot less gun violence than if you have 100,000 people and 100,000 guns. You just, the more guns you pour into the system, inevitably, the more people will be hurt or die. And Loaded isn't a story which just looks at mass shootings. It talks about mass shootings, but I also wanted to talk about all the other parts of gun violence in this country that we don't really explore. And I'll mention two. There is the guy who owns a gun, who is a good guy, who works 40, 50 hours a week, who is fun to talk to, who seems decent. But he goes home and he has a couple beers and he's a little bit abusive. And the wife says, I'm out of here. I'm taking the kids. And he goes to the closet and he gets out the 38 and he says, if you ever leave me, I'll kill you. And I'll kill them too. And that scene plays out every night in some household in America, and we're all cool with it. There is this epidemic of suicide, largely among white males, middle-aged white males, and it's suicide by the gun. And it's, you know, the numbers are astonishing. And you say to yourself, well, if all the guns went away tomorrow, those people would still find a way to kill themselves. Actually, that's not true. That's not what the statistics suggest at all. In the United Kingdom, for years, people would kill themselves by turning on the gas in the oven and putting their head in the oven. That's where the phrase head in the oven comes from. In the 1970s, the United Kingdom largely switched over to electric ovens, and the suicide rate plunged. As soon as people didn't have easy, convenient access to a means of suicide, they didn't follow that impulse anymore. So these are all things worth considering in terms of whether anything is going to change. I doubt it. Mm-hmm. Not really. But I can still explore despair in my fiction.
Of course, yeah.
Despair is a completely valid artistic subject.
Certainly. I want to talk about some of the other stories
yeah,
in the book
sure.
as well, because, I mean, these are, they're so cool.
Oh, thank you.
I read this in a weekend and I reread it briefly before coming in to speak with you. And I want to talk about Aloft for a moment, because
right.
that is just a mind-blowing piece of work. Because I read about the concept first before I dove into the story. And the concept is skydiver gets stuck on a cloud.
Right.
And I was like, how in the heck is he going to make this believable?
It's a castaway story, like Robinson Crusoe. It just happens 10,000 feet above the earth.
Yeah. So, I mean, what inspired that story and how did you go about making the concept believable?
In terms of the inspiration, it's really simple. I was on a plane and I looked out the window and I had the idea and then I wrote it. The story Aloft is about a guy named Aubrey Griffin, goes on his first skydive. It goes horribly wrong and he winds up stranded on a semi-solid cloud that seems to respond to his thoughts. So when he needs a coat rack, the smoke of the cloud bubbles up and makes a sort of phantom coat rack for him that will actually he can hang his stuff on, and it makes a bed for him, and it makes a cloud girlfriend for him and a cloud palace for him to live in, and it will give him whatever he wants, but it won't let him go. And part of that story, part of it was just I loved the idea of a castaway story with such a strange setting. And that story is also partially about how all of us sort of live in a world that's 50% true and 50% what we want to believe, that a lot of what we know about other people is a mixture of fact and hope or fact and imagination. And I sort of wanted to write a story about a guy who believes some things about a girl he's passionately in love with, who is gradually forced to face the fact that a lot of what he fell in love with was imaginary, that it was his own set of fantasies, which maybe have no real bearing on reality.
Aloft is just one of many examples of the stories you've written over the years where you just take a concept and you make it believable. And like another example is from 20th Century Ghosts, the story Pop Art.
Right.
Where there's a person who is inflatable.
Right. Pop Art is the story of a friendship between a juvenile delinquent and an inflatable boy named Arthur Roth. Arthur is weighs about 12 ounces, and if he sat down on a sharpened pencil, it would kill him. That was actually that was the first short story I ever wrote that made me really, really happy. That was sort of a creative turning point for me. I sometimes think that, you know, my whole career pivoted on that one short story, which I believe I wrote in 1999.
Wow. So what made it such a crucial pivot point? Was it an idea that you didn't think you could pull off and then bam, you did?
One of the things we haven't talked about is that, and I don't go out of my way necessarily to advertise it, but, you know, one of the things we haven't talked about is that I come from a writing family. My dad's Steve King. My mom's Tabitha King. My brother writes. Owen King, terrific writer. His wife, Kelly Braffett's a great writer. When I was in college, I decided to drop my last name and start writing as Joe Hill. And I did it because I was terrifically insecure. And I needed to know for me when I sold a story that I was selling it for the right reasons, not just because I had a famous dad. And the other thing I decided when I was in college and I decided I wanted to be a professional writer was that I wasn't going to write fantasy, that I wasn't going to write stories of the supernatural, because that would also be falling into the trap of risking being my dad's son. And so I did that for years, and I wrote a lot of not very good New Yorker-type stories. You know, a lot of – and it was weird. It was a weird choice for me to make because I had grown up reading writers like Neil Gaiman and Alan Moore, who told stories to fantastic, Ray Bradbury and Arthur Conan Doyle. So it was a real turning away from all the stuff. And I was a huge Stephen King fan. After I had been writing these faux New Yorker stories for a few years, I read an essay by Bernard Malamud called Why Fantasy? And I revered Malamud. And in it, he said that since all fiction was make-believe, the tools of fantasy were as valid as anything else, and that you could do, whereas the tools of fantasy were as valid as the tools of naturalism or realism. And he talked about, you know, Lewis Carroll's Wonderland and Philip Roth's New Jersey have something important in common, which is that neither of them exist. They're both complete imaginary constructions. We think New Jersey is real when we read about it in Philip Roth's stories, but it's really just Philip Roth's imaginary New Jersey. It's not the real place. And this essay by Malamud was tremendously freeing. And I suddenly realized, you know, I'm not... When I write as Joe Hill, no one has any idea who my dad is, and I can write whatever I want. And if I want to write about ghosts, I can write about ghosts. And if I want to write a story of the weird and the fantastic, I can do that. And set free by this essay, I wrote Pop Art. I wrote it very quickly. It was tremendously satisfying. And I was sort of on my way to becoming the writer I became.
Do you still feel insecure?
Yeah, I do. I still wrestle with a lot of anxiety about, you know, every new book is a fresh test. Will they like it this time? Will people enjoy it? Did I do a good job? Will they get bored, toss the book, and go look at YouTube or Twitter? But I am a lot more comfortable in my skin than I used to be. Before it came out about my pen name, before people found out about my dad, I had a chance to get some validation. I sold some stories. I got in a best of collection. I sold my first book of short stories to a small press in England. It was turned down by every publisher in New York. It was turned down by every publisher in London. But 20th Century Ghost sold to Peter Crowther at PS Publishing, and he did 1,500 copies. And for me, that was tremendous validation. He bought the book not because I had a famous dad. He didn't know anything about my family. He bought the book because he loved the stories. So by the time it came out, I had built up a little more of a sense of self-worth. I was a little more comfortable in my own skin. And then over the years, I've been very fortunate. People seem to have enjoyed the stories. And that does come with a little bit of a growing sense of confidence, like, you know, maybe I'm not too bad at this. And I'm not my dad, you know. he can do in 6 months what it takes me 3 years to do. It took me 3 years to write Nosferatu. It took me 3 years to write Fireman. And I think I'm proud of them. I think they're good books. My dad could have written the same books in less than half the time. You know, he's an absolute engine of story, and I'm just blown away with it. But I am proud of the books I have written, and I feel good about them, and I think that mostly people who read them like them.
Mm-hmm. And that comes with experience, right? If you do it for decades and decades, you get faster.
It does. I mean, I've been publishing now for, I started publishing my first short stories in the late 90s. My first book came out, that small press edition of 20th Century Ghosts, in 2005. I wrote a 6-volume graphic novel series that won some prizes and is being made into a TV show. There was a film made out of the second book, Horns. You knock around for a while, and if you're lucky, you do have a chance to, develop a little mental security that maybe you have found something you can do.
I wanted to ask you about the length of these stories too.
Right.
You chose short novels for Strange Weather, and you've written stuff that's much longer. Fireman is huge. Nosferatu is huge. What appeals to you about this length, the short novel?
I think stories of the weird and the supernatural, stories of suspense, stories of horror, really live their best lives a lot of times at a length of about 75 to 175 pages, that the story of suspense that can be read in a single sitting is often the most satisfying and entertaining most satisfying and most entertaining form the thriller can take. And, I'm thinking about stories like Henry James's Turn of the Screw, Woman in Black by Susan Hill, no relation, Ocean at the End of the Lane by Neil Gaiman. That's 180 pages. And I don't think it's his best novel, and I don't think there's a single wasted word in the whole book. And I got talking about these lean, taut, single-sitting stories of menace. And someone said, so you're fighting that Dickensian impulse that this is sort of a counter to the Dickensian impulse in fiction. And I said, actually, I don't think so, not at all. Because, we know Dickens, of course, wrote these big, sprawling novels filled with characters and subplots, juicy subplots and texture. But when you think about Dickens' best-known work, his single best-known work, the work of fiction that almost everyone on planet Earth knows, that's a 100-page ghost story called A Christmas Carol that can be read in a single sitting. So Dickens is actually sort of an argument for, he's exhibit A for why these kind of stories can be so great.
Cool. And I wanted to ask about the story Rain, because you wrote here, was that you wrote that you had to change the ending somewhat as a result of, maybe you didn't have to change it, but you wanted to change the ending as a result of what happened with the presidential election last year. Tell us about your thinking on how to shape that story with respect to the election.
We're all very aware of climate change, and it's weird because it's sort of tough to think about. We know the world's getting a little warmer, sea levels are rising a little bit, there have been some mean hurricanes, but it's such a big problem, and it's sort of so nebulous and it's happening so slowly, it's hard to wrap your head around it. And I was thinking about climate change, and I thought, what would people have to respond to? How would the climate have to change so that people had to react, where it would mean something to us? And I thought, you know what? If the climate changed so that clouds started raining nails instead of water, then we'd stop arguing about it and we'd start thinking about it as a problem. So I wrote this story, Rain, about thunderstorms of, thunderclouds that rain nails, and people are getting shredded apart in the streets. It's destroying infrastructure. If you're out on the interstate and it starts raining, it's like your car is getting strafed with machine gun fire. And in the midst of this, so my lead character in this story is a woman named Honeysuckle Speck. Who is sort of an inspiring, she aspires to belong to law enforcement. And in the course of this growing global catastrophe, she begins to work to solve a series of apparently trivial puzzles that turn out not to be so trivial once she's solved them. So I wrote this Armageddon story, and when I wrote it in, I want to say, early 2016, and the president of America at that time, and that version of the story, was this tired, besieged, but basically competent woman. And then the election happened. I thought, well, I'm going to have to change that now. So I revised it, and, I want people to laugh. And I thought, well, what would be the funniest thing I could do to this revision? I thought, wouldn't it be funny if the president kept tweeting his crazy tweets. And I thought, I'll have him tweeting during the apocalypse. People will think that's funny. Because I assumed he wouldn't keep tweeting that way, that it wouldn't be like, you know, every day wouldn't be like an episode of, you know, WWF, you know, wrestling with a lot of online taunting and stuff. So when I stuck it in there, you know, I have him tweeting our way towards nuclear war. It never crossed my mind that by the time the book got published, that would actually be a vaguely plausible scenario.
Yeah, that part of the book was totally plausible.
You know, so people who listen are going to think, you know, this is a book with a political agenda. The actual agenda of the story is to be scary. You know, of the stories is to be scary, to be fun, to keep people turning the pages. You know, and so, you know, the first story, Snapshot, is about a boy in a desperate struggle with a man who has a camera that can steal memories. And that's one story. And Loaded is about the scariest figure in America right now, which is the gun nut. We're all terrified to, you know, our nerve endings by the gun nut. And so I wanted to write about that. Aloft is about the fear of heights and about the fear of isolation and being stranded and dying of exposure and starvation. And then Rain is about the fear that you know, the very weather we live with could turn lethally against us. And in each case, the goal was to entertain. But I do think if you do your job well and if you're attuned to what's going on in the society around you, sometimes a story will assume other resonances. And you know, it's true. Thunderclouds are not going to start to rain nails, but if you're living in Puerto Rico or if you're living in the coast of, you know, the Gulf Coast of Texas, you know the weather can be pretty mean anyway, can be pretty cool and uncaring, and that's scary.
Yeah, I mean, so many of our fears, right, are tied into life living in a society with other
right.
people, some of whom are healthy, some of whom are not.
Are not.
Yeah.
Are not. And this is why we turn to fiction. This is what fiction is for. You know, there are questions we don't want to think about because they're too upsetting. Like, you don't want to think, what if the diagnosis comes back and it's cancer? You know, and I'm going to find out that the clock is ticking down, you know, and ticking down fast. It's fears of your own mortality are terrifying, and we don't generally like to wrestle them with them in a conscious way on a daily basis. But we can turn to a work of fiction, and in a work of fiction, we can read about a vampire that is slowly draining someone's life a day at a time, making them weaker and weaker, and this person's time is running out before they join the ranks of the dead. The metaphor is pretty obvious. Okay, the vampire is a stand-in for cancer. The vampire is the stand-in for the illness that could threaten your life. And in the safe playground of fiction, we can take an idea like that and we can have fun with it and we can experience a little emotional rehearsal, a little psychological rehearsal for what the real thing might be like. Not the vampire, but the illness, which is what the vampire stands for. And I think that's important. I think that good fiction is about something larger than just a clever idea.
I want to make I don't know if it's a confession, but I want to tell you something that experienced about a year ago. I was at Bull Moose in Exeter.
Mm.
Not Exeter,
Portsmouth.
Excuse me, Portsmouth.
Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Yeah, I was at Bull Moose in Portsmouth. Mike Doty was doing a live concert.
I was there. Were you there?
And you were there, and I recognized you, and I was like, that's Joe Hill. And I got super excited because I loved your work. And I was with my girlfriend, and she's like, go say hi. And I was like, I don't want to bother him. Like, you were looking through the vinyl.
Yeah.
And I think you bought something, but I wasn't quite sure. You know, fast forward to now where I've read a bunch of your books and there's so much music in the books. I mean, Heart-Shaped Box, right? The guy's a rock star.
Right.
In Aloft, in this book, he was in a band with...
He's a cellist.
Yeah, he was in a group with the girl who died and the girl for whom he did the tribute Skydive.
Right.
So I wanted to ask you about music in your life. I mean, maybe I'll start with the vinyl. Are you a huge vinyl fan? Are you a collector of vinyl?
I am. I've gone completely back to vinyl almost, you know, that's most of my listening. Part of that is because when I'm working on the computer, if I'm writing something, if I'm revising something, I try to be disconnected from the internet. And so much of our music is stored online. I love listening to vinyl because it never bleeps with a text message. The record never gets interrupted with a phone call. It just plays. And also, a well-constructed album is a little bit like reading a novella. You know, it has a story. It has themes that play out across a dozen tracks, and randomly skipping through, you know, a selection of favorites on a playlist can be a lot of fun sometimes, but I like the story. I like to get, you know, I like to get one voice, you know, I like to, you know, throw on, you know, an old Ray Charles album or something and follow that train of thought from side A to side B. So, I mean, the other thing is I'm a huge British Invasion guy. I love the Beatles, Stones, Who, Zeppelin, Kinks. You know, I grew up with that music. I don't know when I became completely obsessed with it, but I managed to get all my kids obsessed with it too. I have three teenage boys. The oldest boy is a tremendous drummer. The middle boy shreds. He's a great guitarist. The youngest boy sings. And
do you play?
I play a little piano very badly. I can play Werewolves of London. That's almost cool. Like professionally required, though. When you write horror fiction, you have to know how to play Werewolves of London, and you got to go home.
Okay.
Or at least you got to know the lyrics by heart. So, and I've managed to work my Beatles Stones obsession into almost every single book. You know, it's there in The Fireman. It's there in Heart Shaped Box. It's there in Nosferatu. It's there in Horns. There's one of the last part of Horns is titled The Gospel According to Mick and Keith, you know, and
Horns itself has a double meaning. It's the horns of the devil and then the horns that are played as musical instruments in his family.
It is the horns, right? It is like the horn section. And the other thing, it's actually a word with many, many meanings. Ig, the lead character of Horns, goes through a period of torment because he believes his girlfriend has been unfaithful to him. And of course, the Elizabethan meaning of wearing the horns was, you know, to be cuckolded by your lady. So that's all there. And there's a lot of wordplay in Horns. There's more wordplay in Horns than there is in pretty much anything else I've ever written.
I know you're just launching this one, but do you have your next project in mind?
So Gabriel Rodriguez and the artist Gabriel Rodriguez and myself spent 7 years working on a comic book called Lock and Key. And Lock and Key is about a haunted New England mansion full of enchanted keys, and every key activates a different door with a different supernatural power. And this comic has a beginning, middle, and an end. It is a complete story. It's not like The Flash, where it's like, you know, The Flash has been around for 50 years, and every issue he just keeps flashing. You know, nothing else happens. He's just flashing again. So that is being turned into a TV show by Hulu, and they're filming it now up in Nova Scotia. And Carlton Cuse is producing, and it's being directed by Andy Muschietti, who directed a great horror film called Mama and another picture that did okay this summer about a clown. I forget the title.
Escapes me.
Yeah, but that was a pretty good one, too.
It's it, by the way. It is it.
It's got Danny Glover in it, and it's got Francis O'Connor. I wrote the first script and the second script, and I've been working on the third script with a terrific writer named C. Robert Cargill, who wrote the screenplays for Doctor Strange and Sinister, and has a terrific novel out now called Sea of Rust, which is like Mad Max Fury Road. It's awesome, awesome science fiction. But I'm very hands-on with the show. We haven't got a series order yet, but the pilot looks incredibly cinematic and beautiful. So I'm very hopeful that we'll be on next summer. Touch wood.
Well, Joe Hill, thank you very much for speaking with me about Strange Weather.
I had such a good time. Thanks for having me on.
That's Joe Hill. He's the author of the new collection of four short novels, Strange Weather. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Joe's bookshelf at our website, nhpr.org. We're always looking for reading recommendations from listeners like you. Tell us about the book you think other listeners should check out. Our email address is books@nhpr.org. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.